Welcome back to New Books in Native American Studies. I'm Andrew Epstein, and thanks for listening to this podcast for the New Books Network. Each episode, we pick a recently published work in Native American and Indigenous Studies and spend the hour speaking with the author. My guest today is Eileen Morton Robinson, Professor of Indigenous Studies at Queensland Institute of Technology in Brisbane, Australia. She's a First Nations scholar who's published numerous books, including Sovereign Subjects, Talking Up the White Woman, and a collection of essays in social and cultural criticism she edited entitled Whitening Race. Her most recent book, just out from the University of Minnesota Press, is The White Possessive: Property, Power, and Indigenous Sovereignty. Collecting a decade's worth of work, Morton Robinson is motivated by two fundamental questions. How did Aboriginal people come to be known as racialized subjects? And second, is this knowing implicated in a structure of white subjectivity that is tied ontologically to the possession of Aboriginal lands and Aboriginal people? While her work emerges out of an Australian context, her answers have broad resonance with multiple colonial worlds, including on the lands now occupied by the United States and Canada, indeed wherever whiteness operates possessively, in her words, to define and construct itself as the pinnacle of its own racial hierarchy. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Professor Eileen Morton Robinson, welcome to New Books in Native American Studies. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for the invitation.
Of course. So I want to begin by asking you to just introduce yourself and perhaps talk a bit about your disciplinary location or locations within the Australian academic world, which I know precious little about, and talk about what you teach and research there.
Okay. I'm a Gurumpa woman of the Condamooka First Nation people, and my location, or my people's land, is just outside Brisbane, which is the capital of Queensland, one of the states of on the eastern side of Australia. I am Professor of Indigenous Studies at Queensland University of Technology, where I teach basically to postgraduates, or I guess in the American context, to graduate students. And that teaching involves basically around research capacity building, which I've been involved in now for some time, I guess, since I was appointed to the job at QUT. So my research interests, you know, in one regard, has always been around whiteness and race, particularly since my PhD, and gender. And I guess that's, you know, I have utilized that in my teaching about research and research capacity building. But also, I guess I have to sort of qualify that my disciplinary training as an undergraduate was in sociology, and I moved from sociology then in my PhD to feminism. And after completing the dissertation, I then moved into critical whiteness studies. I think that should cover about what I do, I guess, or where I am.
I see that you're also director of the National Indigenous Research and Knowledges Network. Could you talk a bit about the work you do there?
Okay, that's a national hub, what we call hub and spokes model, whereby we run research capacity building initiatives for early career researchers and also for postgraduate students. Again, these are around things that in the Australian context, which is different to the American in that we're far more aligned with the British system of education. So here, a PhD is actually usually a dissertation of between around 85 to 120,000 words, and that's usually completed in 3 years. In the traditional sense, there was no coursework attached to that. So part of my capacity building, I guess, in the Australian context has been to work with postgraduate students who are in the throes of doing their dissertation, and to work with them in terms of developing Indigenous research methodologies, as well as thinking about research methods and how they operationalize their standpoint within within the scholarship. And tied to that is also the other things about what is it to be an academic, what are the things that you need to know, just minor things like how to develop your curriculum vitae for positions, what does it mean to seek promotion within the academy, how do you move from being a basic lecturer A through to a professor. Again, slightly different from the American system. We have like lecturer A, B, C, D and E, so there's five tiers in Australia through movement through that system. And so it's those kinds of things that we run workshops around. And also we do critical reading groups. So since my association with the National or the Native American and Indigenous Studies Association, I've sought to bring aspects of the scholarship into the curriculum for people to engage with. For example, we covered Audra Simpson, her book on theory. We'll be looking again at some of her work on Mohawk interrupters, Glenn Coulthard's work, Chris Anderson's work, Robert Warrior's work. Daniel Heath Justice. Mm-hmm. Quite a number of Indigenous scholars whose work I try and operationalise here in order to connect students here with different ideas to utilise in their work.
That's wonderful. As far as I understand the story of Indigenous studies, critical Indigenous studies within the US academic context, it roughly tracks back to the 1960s and the 1970s. It was hard-fought struggles on multiple campuses in the United States, and then over the decades that followed, efforts to cohere a national network of scholars and researchers. NYSA, as you mentioned, is only about 8 years old. Is this story similar in the Australian context? Do the spaces for critical Indigenous studies within Australian universities date back to roughly the same period in the 70s?
Yes, it does. Except in Australia, there isn't the critical mass of scholars that, for example, exist within the USA or Canada or Hawaii, for that matter. We still predominantly Indigenous studies is held by non-Indigenous scholars. Right. So we're in that sense behind, I guess, I would say, the United States. And I think part of that it has to do with the fact that we didn't have access to the tertiary, sector until the 70s, late 70s. Right. So at the moment we only have 336 Indigenous scholars with PhDs nationally. So we're, we're growing in number, but part of the lag is really due to the fact that there hasn't been a lot of people coming through with PhDs, and that when I received my PhD in 1999, I was number 22. So it's, a lot of it's got to do with the fact of entrance and also support. Like even today, there's not a lot of support for Indigenous postgraduate students in Australia, and the cohort still roughly is basically mature age students who've got mortgages, families, community, it's hard going. So part of the development of NIRICN, which is the National Indigenous Research and Knowledges Network, was for me I wanted something that I could actually start, I guess, a trajectory and a supportive environment for postgraduate students and early career researchers in Australia to be part of a movement to begin to establish critical Indigenous studies in the Australian context.
That's great. Well, thank you for getting us up to speed on that. And I know many of my listeners are in North American context, and so it's good to hear about the work that's happening there. I want to turn now to your really incredible book. That's what we're here to discuss today. It's called The White Possessive, Property, Power, and Indigenous Sovereignty. It's just out from the University of Minnesota Press. And this is a book that takes up diverse terrains of social life on multiple continents. But if there's a concept that binds these chapters together, it's suggested in the title, this idea of possessive logics, their relationship to racialization and whiteness on usurped Indigenous lands. I'm hoping you can introduce us to the idea of possessive logics as you understand them, and what kind of work that this concept can help us do in stitching together this research agenda.
Okay. I guess that the idea of the possessive logics for me came after years of thinking about, let me put a context to it. I was, when I came to the university, I had a year seven education. So I was not well educated in that sense. Mm. But I had grown up, I was raised by my grandparents, and so very much in a traditional setting. So I was very cognizant, I guess, of the fact that of being immersed in a different episteme. Mm-hmm. And that kind of crystallized for me more so when I went to university, because I was very much a political activist, and what I actually began to understand, I guess, in that political activism was that I could not grasp this shifting all the time of the terrain. So that just when you thought that you had knowledge about something, then there would be a movement where you would constantly almost be like in a state of perpetual dispossession in relations with the state. So I knew that there were things that I didn't know. And for me, going to university, that was the purpose. So I began, reading crazily around different areas. I of course latched onto Marxism, because it spoke to me about oppression and the poor. And but I also understood that that was limited in the sense that it spoke of a time and a place beyond my people's place. And so I really wanted to kind of understand it, because I knew that the logics of capitalism were very much in which we were immersed. But I also wanted to understand it because I wanted to kind of think about what kind of subject that it produces. So after reading Das Kapital, I kind of started to think, a little bit about how the subject is formed through acquisition and what that connection is in terms of the taking of other people's lands. So I was trying to work out, if there is this kind of need to possess, where does it come from? How does it begin? And that, of course, led me in later on in my scholarship to Michel Foucault. Mm-hmm. And it was actually reading his work, in particular, Society Must Be Defended, that I started to galvanise my ideas around the idea that there is actually like one of the, parts of the episteme that came out of the Enlightenment, that as much as classification, categorisation, operationalised an episteme, so did possession. And this is not something that Foucault really talks about. It's actually something, I guess, that Morton Robinson talks about. So I began to kind of, by reading Foucault, think more about how how a possessive subject is produced through capitalism, but not just in the sense of owning property as a materiality, form of materiality, but really about how discursively one can possess. And by that, I mean it's like the kinds of regulatory mechanisms of the state in terms of our relations with it through citizenship and rights. They in and of themselves are possessions that we take up, the way in which we can think about identity as a form of possession, the way in which we basically, you know, are, of course, sucked into consumption through possession, you know, in terms of the need to acquire and to accumulate. So there's this, to me, there were a whole a range of things, I guess, which is why in some ways people say that my work addresses a broad canvas. I suppose that it does, but I've really been trying to grapple with these logics and how they manifest. Part of it is a political agenda as much as it's an intellectual agenda, in the sense that I think that if we are to change our relationships with the planet, we have to become less possessive subjects. And I don't know if that answers your question.
Very, very much so, and I have many more that are coming to mind as I listen to that. You talk about that and thinking particularly about the kinds of possession that are disavowed by white subjects in these contexts. But before we get into that, I guess I want to say that this is a book that not only identifies certain maybe shortcomings is not the right word in conceptions within various intellectual fields, but also points the way, I think, through looking at various places and modes and case studies of how scholarship might better engage and dismantle these possessive logics. But I do want to spend some time on the limitations within existing intellectual production as you see it, namely within Indigenous studies and in whiteness studies. And you talk about in the introduction about discovering a certain race blindness within Native American and Indigenous studies and a continued emphasis on culture. And I wonder if you could talk a bit more about why that's a problem and what do you think accounts for that problem?
That is something I'm still trying to grapple with. I think that It became quite clear for me when I started to actually read and engage with the critical whiteness studies literature and even the race literature in the States, and then to kind of move into reading the Indigenous literature, I could kind of see that there was, on the one hand, the critical whiteness studies basically somehow, you know, predicated itself on a trope of migration in which slavery was also a part of that. So the kind of foundations of the United States, in one sense, the way in which race theorists have written about it, is through slavery. Mm-hmm. And it just seemed to me that, you know, slavery really is an outcome and as much as it is produced by colonization. And that if we think about it just in a very, you know, kind of to me a very simple way, I guess, is to, you know, you can't have slaves without dispossessing and taking Native American people's land first. So it seemed to me that it was a little bit more complex in terms of the way in which race took hold in the United States than the assumption that it becomes something that is only the prison of the African American. Mm-hmm. Now, I guess in terms of the way in which you must admit, I'm reading the American literature very much through an Australian Aboriginal woman's lens, that when I read the literature, it is not as though race is not named. I mean, Vine Deloria did you know, name race, but it is as if it never becomes a key analytical category. Mm-hmm. So it is understood that the term Indian is racist. It is, you know, there are understandings and writings around that, but it seems to me that they're not clearly expressed through analysis about how racialized knowledge produces the Indian, for example, mm-hmm. you know, and the fact that this knowledge presupposed the taking of land. So I think that in that sense, for me, it's like, you know, I actually believe that race was crucial to colonization in its many forms. And I disagree with Foucault in the sense that he says that prior to the 17th century, it's a linguistic marker. I actually think it's far more than that. And that it may not be race in the purely biological constructionist sense of, you know, after the Enlightenment, but it fundamentally to me is there in the way in which people of color are portrayed. And I guess one of the most, you know, we only need to think about the Crusades into the Holy Land. We only need to start looking at the kind of artwork that's developed and the way in which people of color are portrayed in all kinds of ways to do with darkness, to do with evil. So I think that the kind of traces of the way in which, you know, race as a biological construct, let me go back a bit. I think that the idea around race as a biological construct certainly was informed by knowledges that pre-existed the development of science. Mm-hmm. And so I'm, you know, and I think about when I read some of Captain Cook's entries, for example, and you kind of see that there's a racialized knowledge that's actually working in the way in which this man is, even when he's sailing up the east coast of Australia, is looking, you know. So we are already known before we are even engaged. Mm. And the question for me then becomes, okay, so if we are already known prior to colonization, then how are we known? And that, of course, is why, you know, for me, Foucault was an important intervention, I guess, for me in terms of my thinking, because I was, you know, not convinced, I guess, with the ideas around, you know, race purely kind of being connected to science as a biological construct.
I wonder if the aversion to race as an analytic within at least mm-hmm. North American Indigenous studies has to do with the fact that it's a fear around perpetuating a sort of misrecognition of mm-hmm. the fundamentals of Indigenous sovereignty, political relationships to land, membership, citizenship in First Nations, that obviously is so much not about, at least in self-understandings, about race per mm-hmm. se, though you're also asking for not just to interrogate race as a white problem, as a problem of whiteness and a problem of that even if it's a form of misrecognition, it still needs to be interrogated because it has such profound impacts on how the colonial society operates. Is that fair to say?
Yes, that's fair to say. I mean, I want to kind of like be really clear that actually when there are our knowledges, for example, as Indigenous peoples, like you will find in most languages that there really isn't a concept of race, right? So when we draw out our own knowledges, you know, we may have had despairing things to say about other groups, but usually it is not in racialized terms. So the epistemes, I guess, that existed prior to our lands being taken, we did not see ourselves in that racialized manner. Mm. And I would argue that part of it is we still don't. So that whole kind of thing to me around misrecognition is really to speak from a sovereign episteme. And I can understand that, but it is, and that it, that I believe is what Foucault would call the counter discourse. Mm. But what I kind of feel is left out is that when we make when we assert sovereignty without understanding how racialized knowledge and racism, or naming it and analyzing it as such, that we fail to basically look at the workings of racialized power. And that is, to me, what we're up against. You know, so it's the link between race, rights, and sovereignty, and how that Indigenous peoples are, you know, are forced to grapple with in our everyday lives, because of the presumption of already being known, in a racialized way, rather than in terms, not in terms of our own epistemes, if I can make that clear. That's,
So turning to the first chapter, entitled I Still Call Australia Home, you interrogate some of these epistemes. You interrogate what you call the incommensurable difference between, on the one hand, the Indigenous sense of belonging and home and place, and the sort of capital and colonial logics of the Australian nation state. I know you've mentioned this already in our conversation, but what are some of the elements of this difference as you understand them?
Okay. I can really only speak in the Australian context.
Sure.
And very much about my own people. For the Quandamooka people, we exist because the creator beings made us, and everything around the land, the sea. And so who we are as a people are very much tied to who created us. So in that sense, I cannot go and become a Walpri person from the Central Desert, for example. I may actually be taken in through adoption to the Walpri, but I cannot be in and of Walpri. I am really in and of only Quandamooka. So who I am is tied integrally to the tracts of land and that the creator beings made. And so sovereignty in that sense for us is what we call bloodline to country. So it means that I am tied integrally to that lands in ways in which I am not tied to others. And therefore my being is about being Quandamooka. So that's a different form of sovereignty. And it's not that that doesn't have rights, obligations, ceremonies, et cetera, around becoming and being, but it is a way in which one is, and I think as I become older, I realise it's why the law, for example, and the idea of Western sovereignty in terms of, you know, the composition of internal integrity and the way in which it's, you know, tied up with rights in the state can't see or can only seek to see our sovereignty in frames in a frame that it itself can understand and develop. So that's the incommensurability. It's like, I can't be anything other than Quandamooka, but under the logic of capital, you know, I can actually go and be I could appeal and hope for, you know, USA citizenship through some means. So that kind of incommensurability is about place and being and creation that is distinct from the logic of capital. It is not to say that, you know, Aboriginal people are outside the logic of capital. We are not, but it is to understand that there is an episteme that operates outside of that logic as well as within it. And it is, you know, and I would argue that this is really what's at work, I guess, for all Indigenous peoples who resist. You know, it is as if our existence, in one sense, ontologically disturbs the colonizer. You know, it disturbs that particular way of being because it is a reminder of who are the original peoples. Mm-hmm. So I see the incommensurability in that sense that the ideas of sovereignty and are different, and that they're not tied to the same logics.
What do you mean by a post-colonizing society in Australia? I don't think I was familiar with that term. I've heard of sort of post-colonial or mm-hmm. settler colonial. And along those lines too, I'm wondering, it seems to me that settler colonialism as a concept is not one that you want to operationalize in your own work. Is that fair to say? I did not see it. I saw post-colonizing society as opposed to perhaps in many contemporary North American writings, we see a lot of talk of settler colonialism. I'm wondering mm-hmm. if there's a tension there for you.
Yeah. I take the view that colonization continues in a different form mm-hmm. and hence the post-colonizing. So it's colonizing rather than colonial. Mm-hmm. I wanted to make it more of a, you know, to be active. And to signify that there is also the other side of the resistance in that, so that I'm not, you know, I'm uncomfortable with settler colonialism because I think that it implies a number of things it's almost in the utterance of settler, one accepts the legitimacy of the state. Mm. And just to tie that with colonialism doesn't necessarily undermine that which prefaces it, right? So settler colonialism as a concept for me is problematic at that level. So I don't use it because I think that it's it doesn't speak to, I guess, my intellectual and political pursuits. I do not accept the claims of the legitimacy of the state in Australia. Mm-hmm. Like I see it, we are actually have illegal occupation. Mm-hmm. So if I see that we have illegal occupation, then I cannot accept the term settler colonialism, right? Like and it is a legal occupation. We have no treaties here, and even that in itself, I think, is problematic. But it seems to me that I think settler colonialism, I probably need to think about it more, but it just, you know, it's just one of those terms that I just go, no, I can't do this.
Mm.
No, well, it's just to say that, so, you know, at a discursive level, at the epistemologic level, there's an acceptance of settlement in the very word.
Yes, yes.
And therefore an acceptance of the legitimacy of the state. So I'm sort of coming, I guess, from Quandamooka mm-hmm. and saying, no, you illegally occupy mm-hmm. my land.
And I think that is a formulation that is far more politicizing, I would say, than one of my concerns with settler colonialism is that I find, and I have only begun to sort of put some thoughts together on this too, is that it can be somehow a depoliticizing framework because it implies, as you say, some sort of finality or perpetual state of being of which there is no necessarily contestation or possibility of decolonization. And again, those are also just initial thoughts, but I appreciate appreciate the distinction you're making there. I was hoping to take a step back and I could ask you about just a few key developments within Australian colonial policy over the past few decades, as I think that they're helpful in understanding what you're talking about in this book. Could I ask you to just talk a bit about the Mabo decision? I hope I'm saying that right, or Mabo decision, the move towards the very fraught and then its subsequent reaction to multiculturalism in the 1990s.
Okay, so the I guess what happened in Australia, I guess, in the 90s was the High Court decision that recognised native title of Indigenous peoples. This was huge for Australia, Aboriginal people, because it was really the first time that the law recognised that we were more than flora and fauna, and which is basically how we were positioned very much from the beginning. When I think, as you've seen, I talk about how we were positioned as being in the state of nature.
Right. Terra nullius, is that the concept?
And terra nullius is the concept, which, you know, basically means uninhabited lands. So the, you know, the premises upon which the patriarchal white sovereignty was established in Australia is through the way in which we were classified within the law. And because of the way in which the law treated us as either flora and fauna, and then later as supposedly subjects of the crown, we were taken into custody, what I'd call taken into custody, so incarcerated on reserves and emissions and also on cattle stations. And we were very much treated as wards of the state. And in that sense, where the state basically determined everything really about your life, and where you could go, where you couldn't leave reserves of your own free will. You were subjected to all sorts of things on the reserves, like in Australia or in Queensland in particular. The rules on the reserves were, you know, right down to the very mundane, like, you know, making sure that you closed the gate after you left the house, making sure that you had the proper swimming attire on, making sure that, you know, you put away your electrical jugs or kettles in a particular way, like who you could marry, and the... you know, and it's not a well-known fact that the South African government actually came to Australia in the 30s and modelled the apartheid system on the reserve system in Australia. Mm. And that's actually, you know, is actually in the government handstands here in Queensland. So we had very much an apartheid system operating in Australia. And when I kind of read about what happened in the States, I mean, similar things of putting people on reserves on the edges of towns, shifting and moving people, like, you know, hundreds and thousands of miles away from their territories. I think I'm getting a little bit lost in my thought there, So over time, those racist pieces of legislation have been revoked. But what the Mabo decision did in particular, the state was actually in a bit of a bind, or the courts were in a bind, because to actually recognise native title and rights, in one sense, also meant that all the legislation that had been utilised to discriminate against us was actually racist and illegal. So in one sense, the High Court got around that by creating in law a new rule of extinguishment, which allowed them fundamentally to retrospectively endorse all the legislation that happened beforehand. And which, if you think about it, means that any claims to compensation and that for what happened is out the window. Because so on the one hand, Mabo tells you you've got native title, blah, blah, blah. And then on the other hand says, oh, yes, but all those horrible things that we did to you, it's all perfectly legal. And so is terra nullius. We just got a little bit wrong, you know. Excuse my sarcasm, but and Mabo, again, gives us a bundle of rights. So what is, and the assumption was that, you know, we would have some form of sovereignty and political sovereignty. But of course, that isn't what happened. What we did was just have formally recognized the rights to which we can go and fish, we can hunt on our lands, and we can take, we can create artifacts on our land. But those things in and of themselves are also circumscribed by other pieces of legislation. For example, on my country, one can only take a bucket full of shellfish because under the Fisheries Act, citizens are only allowed to take one bucket of shellfish, yuggeries we call them, themselves. So what the non-Indigenous people have is what we have. Even though it's recognised as native title, the truth of the matter is that you're fundamentally not really getting anything more than what you had without that formal recognition, because my people still, you know, partake in hunting and gathering and taking yuggeri and other shellfish. We've done that without, you know, any formal recognition of it, and we don't need a recognition by the state because that's part of our sovereign right to do so. But the way in which the native title developed is basically to, give us these insidious forms of rights. For example, the other side of that is there is no right to reside in native title, right? So underneath native title that is actually granted by the state, they create other pieces of legislation that will allow people then to reside on country. But native title in and of itself has no right to reside in it. So the question for me is like, so what does that mean? Mm-hmm. Like, so if the Native Title Act itself does not formally recognise the right to reside, what is it actually giving us? It's not giving us land back. It's giving us use. And that use of things actually has to comply with other pieces of legislation.
With non-Indigenous sort of regulatory. With non,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, so, you know, and yet it's played up as one of the greatest things that's happened when in actual fact what it has done is been quite destructive amongst communities because, of course, as you can imagine, you know, people who all of a sudden think that this recognition is going to bring something, there's power struggles that existed within communities and creating more distress, just health problems, you name it. I mean, it just is really, I think, a very cruel thing that has occurred through native title and to gain the things that we already had. So I'm far more, I think what I've seen over time is the way in which the nation state here constantly portends to give and then takes it at the same time. Mm-hmm. And, because any piece of legislation, as Foucault tells us, any kind of regulatory mechanism never exists in and of itself on its own. It is always worked down in tandem with other pieces of legislation, and we see that even when there are treaties in the states, So I'm kind of thinking that it's probably I've got to do more work on that. But I believe that we are at a time in history where we're actually seeing more and more of our incorporation within the mechanisms of the state through various means.
Huh. Do you put the sort of Australian government apology to Indigenous people in 2008 in that? As Glenn Coulthard, you know, talks about in his book, he views those kinds of apologies that Canada also extended as a similar kind of containment, almost by suggesting that harm or injury is over in some way.
Yeah, I mean, the apology meant a lot to the Stolen Generation in Australia, mm-hmm. and people were very, you know, it had a lot of affect, you know, in that sense. So a lot of emotional capital was invested in it because there was a recognition at one level about that something bad had happened and that people had actually suffered. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that it's that classic kind of, and I put this very much in terms of a kind of the stoic British, attribute of moving on after one apologises, mm-hmm. one moves on. And so, and I agree with Glenn in that sense, what happens is that you become contained through the apology to the degree that it has been stated. And that, but now you have to get over it.
Right.
You know, and so the apology in that sense works in the interests of the white population in Australia because that, you know, virtue can be recuperated by the fact that this statement has been made. And now that we've said we're sorry, we all need to live together in harmony and move on. Mm-hmm. You know, what the apology doesn't do is actually face the fact that that is just the beginning of the journey, that is not the end of the journey.
Similar, too, with the adoption of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, which similarly, I think, has been understood, at least at times, as of a piece with the gestures of apology and reconciliation that have come from the Australian and Canadian governments, less so the United States, though, of course, it's quite telling that the longest holdouts with the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People were the sort of Anglo-colonizing states of the United States and Canada and Israel as a different kind of colonial project. What's your understanding of the UN Declaration of Indigenous People within this book, The White Possessive, and what you call virtuous racial states? Mm. What do you mean there?
That piece, I guess, comes about by this came because of my connections and discussions with colleagues at NASA. I have been talking to Robert Warrior for some time about developing a theory of colonization from empire from indigenous theory. Because when I was looking at the way in which Canada, New Zealand, the USA and Australia responded to the declaration, mm-hmm. in terms of rejecting it, and then when they decided to agree with it, how very similar the discourse was in all of those countries. And that to me, you know, really talked about, well, I saw it as an axis of white patriarchy at work, whose logics, possessive logics, were almost working in tandem to ensure that the Indigenous peoples in those countries' rights were not going to be attended to. And if they were going to be attended to, which is what they then decided, they would be attended to within the mechanisms that already exist. So we're not talking about the rights of Indigenous peoples bringing forth anything really new. We just create or extend policy that already exists all laws that already exist to tick off the boxes of meeting, you know, those declarations. And I think, you know, you can see in the way in which even like Obama, in one sense, has, you know, has a meeting, calls people, all the Native, calls Native Americans to the table to talk. But basically he's still, you know, the language and that he uses to discuss moving forward really are still within the frameworks that already exist. Mm-hmm. So it, and so if, for me, it was about looking at how virtue circulates there, again, about a recuperation. You know, it's like at one level it's, well, no, we don't want it. We can't do this. You know, we can't acknowledge all these things, and let's get bogged down in the UN in talking about whether or not you can classify yourselves as peoples. Let's go on for like over a decade just on that discussion, and you know, so again, to basically hose down aspirations of Indigenous peoples, and also to, I think, work to build what it was how they were going to respond. Even though in not respond, like in saying we're not going to sign off, they seem to me to be rejecting it, because they could, I think they actually really thought that it somehow would question their sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had to grapple with how they could cover that, and hence in the responses, that's what I'm saying, they just move the discourse so that let us embrace these things, but let's embrace them in the way in which we basically are embracing them, you know. So it's no kind of shift to me. And I have read some of the reports from the special rapporteur from the UN on, and that's also borne out by those reports and also the discussions that are still continuing at the UN, that, you know, nothing's really changed for Indigenous people since the declarations come out. Surprise!
Yes, surprise.
Surprise!
Yeah. I think President Obama is particularly adept at that sort of, I don't know if interpolation might be the word, or absorbing within comfortable frameworks things that might otherwise have been insurgent and hard to contain. He's been quite capable at that. I've been speaking with Eileen Morton Robinson, the author of The White Possessive: Property, Power, and Indigenous Sovereignty. It's just out from the University of Minnesota Press. I wanted to ask you about this remarkable cover image on the book. It's a very striking image. I'm wondering if you had particular say in that, or if it spoke to you any particular way, if it was just the wonderful graphic design people at the University of Minnesota Press, who are, I think, quite good among the academic publishers.
I had a say in this, and
you always hear that authors don't, so I never assume. But.
I know. I mean, I've basically had a say in every book, the cover of every book, because I want the cover to signify what the contents are. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want somebody to pick up something that is quite, doesn't speak to the contents. Because, you know, it seems to me to only be fair to those that want to purchase the book that you at least give some sign about the journey that they're going to be on. And also to reflect on the outside of the text, what is also within the text. So I, so what I did was I kind of just did a Google search for a colonial map. Because I wanted something that spoke to the spread of empire. And as luck would have it, this map came up, and it was out of copyright, so it could be used. And I sent it off to Minnesota Press, who fell in love with it and put it together. And I think that, you know, Britannia sitting on the front of the cover in the way in which she does, to me, signifies, you know, spread of empire. But it also, to me, in one sense, signifies, because this is an old map, it is still really a new map. And what I mean by that is, you know, the traces of empire are alive and well. They have not gone. And if they did, well, there'd be a lot of happy Indigenous people. However,
to say the least,
To say the least, but I think so. I did have a say in it, and I love what they did with it. Minnesota Press came up with the apostrophe, and you know, did a fantastic job in putting the cover together. And Jason Weedman in particular was very supportive of this initiative. So I'm, you know, in debt to him, and my gratitude to Minnesota Press for, I think, publishing a book which I didn't really think anybody would be interested in, really. Well, I guess that's still yet to be ascertained, but... I hope that it does a useful work, and I hope that it can take us to think about possession and to think about, you know, what being a possessive subject means in terms of our relations with the planet. And that I'm hoping that my future work will bring that far more clearly into view, so that we can start to think about do we continue on the road that we're on, and the extinction possibly of humans and everything that lives, or do we step back and use some Indigenous philosophy to understand that we as living things are worth no more or no less than all other living things. Therefore, you know, we need to not see ourselves as being worth more than them, and that we can take as if we own everything when we don't.
I think that is the fundamental question of the years to come, when we are now seeing, I think, at a global scale, the impacts of this possessive logic and where it leads.
There's
so much more we didn't get to discuss today. I mean, there's really multiple more incredibly rich and provocative chapters on the beach, which is something I really wanted to get into. And you know, moving towards different research agendas and telling a story about there's a tremendous amount more, and I'd encourage our listeners to pick up a copy as soon as possible. Professor Morton Robinson, thank you so much for your time, and congratulations on the publication of this wonderful book.
Thank you very much, Andrew. It's been a pleasure.
That was Eileen Morton Robinson, author of The White Possessive: Property, Power, and Indigenous Sovereignty, just out from the University of Minnesota Press. You can find us on the web at newbooksinnativeamericanstudies.com, where you can listen to all of the past podcasts free of charge. We're also on iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. For the New Books Network, I'm Andrew Epstein. Thanks for listening.